Good morning, Lubbock, all of West Texas, and wherever you may be listening. This is the Chad Hasty Show on News Talk 790 KFYO. Thank you for tuning in. It's 9:05. Hope you're having a nice Tuesday morning out there. You can dial in at 770-5790, toll free 1-800-687-0790. The first voice you hear from when you dial in, the very talented Ariel Walden on the other side. As always, you can send me an email, chad@kfyo.com. Follow along on Facebook and on Twitter. That's where the show continues all day long. Campaign season is here. It's heating up rapidly out there. And joining me in studio to talk about his reelection campaign, State Representative Charles Perry from House District 83. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Chad. How are you guys doing?
Doing pretty well, pretty good. How about yourself?
Well, you know, getting ready for another tax season, finishing out this one and getting ready for businesses, and then, you know, got a little campaign issue.
Yeah, so you're doubly busy right now.
Yeah.
It's not a downtime.
You know, tax season never stops anymore, but we're finished up some year-end stuff for clients and then getting ready for campaign and tax season.
So. Well, I appreciate you coming in today and talking about your reelection bid. Let's start off talking about your time so far down in Austin. What do you think some of your top accomplishments are?
Well, I can take my push cards from both campaigns, and I'm proud to say that everything on those push cards I have either worked on or was successful in doing, i.e. number one, water. We finally got our water bill funded, first time since 1999. Number two, transformational education reforms and curriculum, where all kids are not meant or should not be expected to go to college. HB 5 in this last session is transformational. Transformational. You talk to any school district, any superintendent, any teacher, and they will tell you that we did something that nobody expected us to get done. It was something that had evolved over several decades with the No Child Left Behind and some other initiatives put in place, all well-intended, but had missed their mark and made high school education pretty much irrelevant to a lot of high school kids. So we fixed that with HB 5. I'm looking forward to looking back 5 years from now, seeing a dropout rate that's less, an employer force that's got trained, skilled employees coming out of public school system with career tech and some of those things that we've put in place. So transformational. HB2, we put some accountability factors into the charter school system. We had allowed charters in, and I'm a charter fan, but it needed some oversight, arguably. So we did some good things on the charter side. So education, and then TRS. You know, I will tell you that for two sessions, and there's not a more active group than our retired teachers, and I love them to death, but they're very vocal, very powerful group. You know, they get together and stick together well. My first session, it was pretty clear. We had a TRS fund that was 83% and heading the wrong way, funded, and largely in part to Senator Duncan. I will give credit where credit's due. He was able to keep his cards close to his vest and through working through some of the state associations, but mainly bringing stakeholders together. We put TRS back on an actuarial sound funding mechanism, and that had never been done, having three stakeholder groups come together and agree that that needed to be done. So if you had to just kind of go back through my push card, and then Obamacare. I was one of those guys in 2010 that talked about doing something, and then this past session I was one of the only reps that actually filed a bill that actually took Obamacare out.
Right.
So there are things that, you know, if you look to your push cards and what is your stance and your platform, if you can go back and check them off, I'm real proud of the fact that pretty much everything on there has been done or at least moved forward or the agenda's been addressed and we'll come back. Medicaid reform, fraud management. Prior to 2010, preventive analytics was not a term you would hear in Health and Human Services. Preventive analytics now has been employed. There's been a vendor hired because of my awareness factor and because of working with Health and Human Services. That's important. That's the budget driver for the state of Texas as well as over our national and all. So I've done what I said I would do. I think people recognize my voting record. I'm number 15 conservative ranking in the House. I was number 3 first session. Had a lot of libertarians get elected last session, so I kind of moved down a little bit. But I've stuck true to the District 83 values, and I think my voting record and the bills I file are very substantive, have very pinpointed directions, and most of them are related to fiscal responsibility. But the school reforms and things that we got done this past session are undeniable, transformational, and solid.
Your opponent, obviously, is big on education, being LIST school board president. He has criticized not only you but other lawmakers for cutting spending not in this past session, but in the session beforehand, where he says that y'all cut $5 billion from education. Let me ask you this. Number one, do you accept the premise that $5 billion was cut? Because there are some arguments. Some say, well, okay, it wasn't cut. You still spent more on education. Maybe not as much as schools wanted you to spend on education, but you still spent more overall. And do you think there is enough being spent on education?
Well, number one, the appropriations is what you need to master. I was lucky to be on the appropriations committee this session, and that's where you learn how state government works. You know, you can't cut something that you didn't have to begin with. And so we were short on growth funding, but it wasn't because we cut. It's because the economy in Texas did not produce that excess revenue or the revenues that we were expecting. You know, we walked in, I've had the tell of two cities. We had $27 million shortfall in the first session and went an $8 billion surplus in the second session. So you talk about getting shotgunned into the system and baptized by fire. We've got to see it all. And there's an experience factor that comes from that's tremendous. But with education specifically, there were real substantive changes made at local and state level in our education funding, but it wasn't a cut. It was the fact that we did not have the revenues to appropriate at that point. And that's the magic of the Texas budget. It self-levels every 2 years. You either come up and you say we had a little more or we had a little less, and we work on it. And that's why Texas is leading the nation in fiscal matters as far as the best bonding rates goes, which we use to borrow money to fund our school districts up front on their monies in August. So there's a lot of interaction and interplay there that works in the state budget that you can't just take out one piece and say that's not how you do it. I mean, you know, it all fits together. I heard a comment that my opponent doesn't play in that area specific to higher ed. We don't get to choice when we're state reps what areas we play in. It's a big state. It's a big budget, a $200 billion budget. But we only control about 17% of that as a state legislature. The rest of it is dedicated because of state mandated, constitutional mandated, or federal mandated. So we're not working with a large checkbook that we have total control over. And therein lies the challenge. And I think we get it right just about every time. And most of my superintendents, I had spent months with them prior to the last session going into the cuts and then post-session. And they told me, and you know, surprisingly enough, they always would like to have more money, but that was not their main emphasis. They've got bigger challenges in our public education system. And that's what I focused on. And that's what they did to their credit. They came substantive meetings with me for months and we worked through it. And every one of them coming back out of this session said, we didn't really think you guys could get it done. And we got a lot of the stuff done. The accountability was restructured. The test taking was restructured. And the curriculum and the five endorsements giving kids pass and options in their public education system. It was a huge probably the best education session that the state has ever had.
In your opinion, and before we go to break, sure. Visiting with State Representative Charles Perry running for re-election, In order to spend more on education, because it seems like there are a lot of folks who they keep on wanting more spent on education. Is there a dollar amount that you have heard that is going to be good enough? And is there a point where you say, okay, in order to raise the spending level on education, we're going to have to raise taxes? Is there a level where that would have to happen?
Well, you're exactly right. There's only so much money. And you allocate that money to the best of your abilities. And anytime you take from one to pay the other, then you're shorting one or giving more to the other. If you want to change that curve, then you obviously have to bring in additional revenue or cut cost. And arguably, we're a pretty lean state per tax person, per capita. We're a very lean state. Being through the budget process and in detail in some of those subcommittee hearings, we don't waste a lot of money. There's opportunities. There absolutely is. And we work every day on where they are. Medicaid entitlements, my bailiwick. That's where I've been because I recognize that in less than probably 10 years, it's going to overtake what we spend in our education. Overall budget, we spend 57% on education overall. From a GR, money that we control, we're at 54%. So it's still the lion's share of the budget. It's the majority of the budget today. Education is, and it should be, and it has always will be, probably until our Medicaid growth and our healthcare system crashes and implodes on us and forces us into making some really hard decisions that we should be working on today. So education is the priority of the budget. It is the number one priority. It is what we focus on when we come into the appropriation cycle. How do we do that?
Mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court, not Dietz. Dietz will come out with some astronomical, unreasonable number in January, as he typically does. But the Supreme Court will decide, one, if they believe that we're adequately funding, and two, they will decide how we distribute that. And that is a fair argument that the distribution of those monies, there has been brighter minds and large minds prior to me for the last 30 years trying to figure out how do we allocate our monies around the state. The current formula was came in 06 after a court hearing, supposed to have been a temporary measure, and we are mm-hmm. still funding under that. Now, I will say in 2011, partly due to the budget crisis, we did put our path on our funding formulas that actually is beginning to level out and bring equality to those districts, where the lion's share of the increase this past session was given to those lower property tax schools. So we are on a path, if you will, of leveling some of that. And I do believe that the Supreme Court will kind of hold and watch that formula work, which is set to expire in 2017, and just see kind of where it's going, because it's operating pretty much where I think everybody understands it needs to go, and it's doing it without the political environment that
right.
you have. Because it's hard to tell somebody from Austin ISD or HHSD on a political side, on the floor. You mm-hmm. want it, you go in there and you battle for it, but when there's 30, you know, 25 reps in Houston or Harris County alone, and you go tell them that they may have to give up some school money for Lubbock, mm-hmm. and there's three, you politically are at a disadvantage on
sure.
that. So that equitable distribution is something that I think we're going to get some direction from their courts. It's not that we have not been working on them. I've seen multiple formulas and runs. I've done them. One I had, Austin, Texas, would lose $60 million. Now, do you think that politically Austin, Texas is going to allow
right.
allow that to happen? So therein lies the challenge with our funding formulas.
Visiting with State Representative Charles Perry, seeking re-election in HD 83. We will take the break. When we come back, we will continue with our interview. We have a lot of other topics to get into as well. We'll be right back. Back on the Chad Hastie Show, State Representative Charles Perry seeking re-election in HD 83, of course, Republican primary. And Representative Perry, just a little bit more on education. And, of course, I asked your opponent about this as well. Your opinions on, and I've asked you this before, mm-hmm. school vouchers, but also charter schools, because charter schools, if Greg Abbott does become governor, as is expected, then charter schools are going to be, from what he has said, is going to be pretty big as far as part of his plans. What are your thoughts on both of those issues?
I support charter schools. I think they provide a choice that doesn't exist without them. I think they also have proven that they can provide unique areas. You may have your indigent, the disadvantaged kiddos that don't fit in a public school environment, or you may have those teenagers that are kind of between years and a little rebellious for the classroom but really want to get finished. So they provide a great venue, but I'm a huge fan of the charter schools, and I could say HB2 actually brought some needed accountability. If you look at a charter school performance and put it to a public school overall and evaluate the entire system, they perform about like our public schools. So I've heard arguments that they're superior. Well, I think if you take the mix across the board, they're about the same performing, but it does give parents a choice or an option, and it gives kids that may not fit in a traditional mm-hmm. classroom environment a way to get through and get their college, high school degree. So I'm for the charter. The vouchers, here's where I'm at with vouchers, and I've been pretty upfront. I serve District 83, and District 83 for two different sessions have been different areas, but I have had the most poorest of poorest district, and I've had the richest of the richest districts. And then when you throw Lubbock into the mix of that. So in my district, District 83, vouchers don't seem to be the right answer. I haven't seen a voucher program yet that takes care of all my concerns when it comes to rural West Texas and an urban mix. But just in general, I haven't seen one proposed. Number two, I've got private schools that are performing at a phenomenal level. And arguably, you would know why. I mean, they're pretty fairly selective sometimes, mm-hmm. But they don't take state money. Therefore, they're not subject to state or federal guidelines. So they don't want the voucher system. We've got homeschool charters, public and private in my district. That said, I do recognize that if you're in a Houston ISD, you're in an Austin ISD, you're in a Dallas ISD, you're in an area where the competition's not there either through charter or whatever. There is probably politically, number one, I think it's going to happen. You've got a governor, you've got some senators that are pushing some pretty big agendas on this. So I think you'll see it move anyway. But I do acknowledge that there in those environments, there may be a need for a voucher. I have not seen a voucher problem that fits their needs either.
Out here in West Texas, it's pretty easy to move around. But in Dallas, Fort Worth, and other places,
that's my answer.
You're restricted.
That was one of my answers, and I spoke to one of the head of teacher groups just last week, and I said, look, in my area, transferability is pretty much unrestricted. Assuming there's capacity and very little disciplinary issues, if that kid's in pretty decent shape, that you can move. And my kids benefited from that. They did not graduate from their home districts. Mm-hmm. And it was a good change for them and a positive change. I think that we've got to revisit that at the state level and make transferability mandated if there is a capacity and the kid is not in a disciplinary. And I even had one superintendent suggest, we'll even take the disciplinary kids as long as there's a probationary period in which maybe if they really do act up, they have to go back to their home district. And the thinking there is sometimes kids just need a change.
Mm-hmm.
They've been labeled. They've been tagged. Maybe they've done something to the coach's kids on the – it just personality.
Sure.
So I thought that was even a good suggestion. So I have been and will be and probably will be advocating hard for a mandated transferability, assuming the capacity is there for the district that would be requiring that transfer E. I think that makes sense. That's something that I did not know. I mean, I said that to a couple of reps on Friday. I said, I don't know what the big deal here is. Well, our kids can move inner districts and then we've got all these other options. And I said, we just don't seem to have that issue out there. And they said, oh, you can't do that in Fort Worth. You can't do that in Houston. You can't do that in Dallas. So we got to break down those barriers. And I think that will be a move in the right direction to force competition in public schools. That's where I'm at with that.
Second Amendment issues, campus carry and open carry.
Campus carry is no problem. I've advocated for it. My kiddos have been through college, and they're both responsible around guns. They CHL carrier, my son is. My daughter is not. But, just the idea that if that was available and she could go to her car late after class – no problem with campus carry at all. Criminals don't read no gun or gun-free zones. They don't participate. And my son is responsible enough that it would be a short order if someone came into a classroom. So mm-hmm. I like that defense. Open carry, very clearly, I'm against that. And if you'll question your national gun rights groups, the NRAs and those guys, they'll pretty much tell you that's not an initiative they want to push either. Specifically, three reasons. I think people need to know why I think the way I do.
Sure.
Number one, concealed carry is a defense mechanism. You don't know I got it, and I use it if it's in a defense posture. I think when you strap one on for visible, it changes that dynamics to offense. It brings attention to you because you have a gun. So there's an offensive play there versus a defense. I think that's the number one issue. Number two, there's a testosterone level. I think that I hate to say it, but we live in an angry society, and you start having those visibles go around. I think it just invites or incites some opportunity there to create a problem that didn't exist had it been a concealed. And number three, we've got political gains in this area. We have had tremendous Second Amendment issues resolved and politically supported. I think you'll see some pushback. There's an old pig theory in life that pigs get fat and hogs get slaughtered. I don't want to be too greedy in our second round. I mean, I'm a supporter and want to be it, but I think the open carry brings in a dynamic of a voter voice that's neutral or supportive that could change that and start taking away some of the gains that we've made. So those are my three reasons for open carry.
State Representative Charles Perry, I appreciate your time. We have run out of time today, but we'll have you back on throughout the primary process to talk about these issues again and other issues that we did not get to today. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate you.